As I said in the previous lecture, I'm not trying to exhaust the myth of Joan of Arc or to tell it to you at very great length. But at this point, it becomes necessary not only to add a little more detail to the story, but also to fit it into the wider context of storytelling in which it belongs. The appearance of Joan of Arc on the French national scene was not apparently entirely unexpected, although our knowledge of what was happening in the villages before she appeared at Vaucouleurs is not at all good. Unhappily, of course, the vast majority of the population of the France, including Joan herself, were not able to either read or write, and the records of the period come from either the clergy or from the relatively limited number of literate laymen in the upper and upper middle classes. But there is very good evidence that there were rumours in the villages before her appearance. When Joan arrived at Vaucouleurs, it's quite possible that there were members of the upper classes, perhaps, of course, Charles himself at Chinon, who'd never heard these rumours, but it is fairly clear that a great many people had, possibly indeed the majority of people in the villages over great areas of France. The rumours seem to have been fairly simple in those early forms. They seem to have been basically a simple dyad: a woman has ruined France, and a virgin will save France. The virgin at that time was very little known, but the woman was only too well known. She was Isabella of Bavaria, widow of the late King Charles VI, and the Dauphin's mother. Isabella was hated, as a number of queens of France of foreign origin have been hated, but hated more particularly as the symbol of the bankruptcy of the French ruling class. A French ruling class whose petty squabbles, love of luxury and frivolity had let the King of England's armies in through Normandy and had plunged France into another cycle of devastation and of fighting. One of the things that Charles was have to do, if he was ever to be King of France, was to live down his mother. Joan herself had probably heard the rumours, and as far as we can see, she introduced herself to the citizens of Vaucouleurs, and probably indeed to some of the soldiers of the garrison, as the virgin in the dyad, the woman has ruined France, and I am the virgin who will save it. One shouldn't perhaps put too much emphasis upon this. The world is full of rumours, and the important feature, of course, of the story of Joan of Arc is not what people might have expected or all sorts of vague hopes that emerged out of the devastation of the age. What is important is what she did. The fact that you are expected does not mean, of course, that when the chips are down, you can do it. What we remember about Joan of Arc is that whoever she was and wherever she came from, she did it. And that's the point of the myth. Last week I told you that the fighting went on long after Joan's death in that old market square at Rouen on May the 30th, 1431. And for a long time, indeed, the King of England and his allies were able to hold a lot of their ground. The Duke of Bedford himself died in 1435, and the Duke of Burgundy, who had long held his troops out of the fighting since, indeed, the summer of 1429, now definitively changed sides back to Charles. In the following year, 1436, the city of Paris, which was basically loyal to the Duke of Burgundy, change sides also. A group of citizens opened one of the city gates and let in one of Charles' armies, commanded by the Breton Georges de Tramouille. The clinching round of the fighting didn't actually come until much later. All through this period, Charles was one of the two rulers anywhere in the world who actually put a huge amount of money into research and development of the big guns that could knock down castle walls and knock down the walls of the great fortified cities like Paris and Orleans, cities which for centuries had defied besieging armies. And when the guns were ready, Charles' captains finally launched what they assumed would be the final solution of the English problem. In 1449, they swept into Normandy, and in two campaigning seasons, they cleared out the unfortunate Edward de la Pole, Earl of Suffolk, who had also, of course, lost against them at Orleans. With a slight breather to regroup, Charles' captains then swept into the Biscay frontage in 1452 and captured the great city of Bordeaux on the Atlantic coast. At this point, they hit a bit of a whoopsie. The people of the southwest had long been used to being under the distant but benign rule of the kings of England. They did not fancy the prospect of being ruled from Paris, and they rebelled against the new government. Charles' captains had to recapture Bordeaux in the autumn of 1453. The citizens called back from his retirement in the British Isles the Lord Talbot, whom Joan and the others had defeated at Patay way back in 1429, and Talbot was killed in the final round of fighting in the breaches at Castillon. Charles himself died in 1461. By one reckoning, he'd been King of France for nearly 40 years. And when he died, he was succeeded uneventfully on the throne of France by his son, Louis. But in those closing years, between the point where the fighting faded out in 1453 and Charles' death, there were some details to which he had paid a good deal of attention. With the capture of Rouen in 1450, the documents which detailed Joan's trial passed into the hands of Charles and of his allies and out of the hands of their enemies. And in 1455, not wasting a lot of time after the end of the fighting in the southwest, a group of clergy loyal to Charles and with the permission of the papacy reopened Joan's trial in the church court in Rouen. It's not necessary for me in a brief survey of this kind to tell you what went on at that second trial. What is, of course, breathtaking for us as modern people revisiting this story in its original form is that, as with her first trial, so with her second, every single word of it was recorded by the clerks of the court at the time. The Inquisition, who supervised the church courts, had a ruling that all proceedings in the court must go into writing. As a matter of regular procedure, they must go into writing and be preserved. For precisely the reason, of course, which was made apparent in Joan's case. Somebody later might want to re-examine the case. As I say, I don't want to go through the detail. This is a highly factional story. It is deeply emotive. The story of Joan of Arc neither occurred nor is remembered in cold blood. It is a story remembered through a red mist, through a veil of blinding tears. And any attempt to talk about what happened in French history at that hinge of feudal and modern times inevitably comes back to the story of Joan and to her two trials. There is good reason. I mean, I don't want to try and pretend that I'm objective or that I have any sort of even-handed approach to this story, but there is good reason, from the evidence, to suppose that Joan was set up, that in her first trial, the Duke of Bedford and the Bishop of Beauvais, doubtless with the best of intentions and with the utmost purity of goodwill, were in fact determined to burn her at the stake, and they fixed a trial to ensure that she was duly burnt. It was not difficult for the second group of judges sitting in that trial of 1455 and 1456 to see that her trial had, in the first instance, been grossly irregular. Again, I don't want to take you into the fascinating legalities of the canon law, but the Inquisition's rules, which governed the procedure in church cases, said that every prisoner before a church court had to be provided with what we would nowadays call a defence counsel. They had to be represented at all times in that court by a trained lawyer. This was a remarkable feature of the church courts, which was only much later taken up by the secular courts. But it is important to point out that Joan was never at any point in her trial provided with a defence counsel. She had to carry out her own defence. Repeatedly, during her trial, she appealed to the Pope. She did not recognise the authority of the court that was trying her. She did not feel the Bishop of Beauvais was a suitable judge in her case. A sound point, really, because, of course, he was hand in glove with the Plantagenet Royal House, who were Joan's most committed sworn enemies. However, every single one of Joan's appeals to the papacy, which were perfectly legal and were part of the normal procedure of those courts, every single one of them was ignored. There was a third irregularity, which is worth mentioning in passing. A woman prisoner who was tried before a church court had to be guarded by women through the whole of the court's proceedings. The usual procedure, which was adopted by the Dominicans, who ran the Inquisition, was to hand female prisoners over to a group of nuns. They were by far the best organised people, the obvious disciplined group of women upon whom the church could call in a legal case of this kind. Throughout the whole of Joan's trial, she was guarded by the King of England's soldiers. Indeed, at one stage, some of them actually attempted to rape her, highlighting, of course, the reason why the Inquisition always insisted, at least on paper, that female prisoners should be held by women and not by men. They didn't specify that those women had to be nuns, but usually they were nuns. The irregularity of the trial of Joan of Arc, therefore, is something which is very difficult to slide away from, even 5.5 centuries later. But it's not my purpose at this point to go into what actually happened, not at this stage. What I'm concerned with is the myth of Joan of Arc. French schoolchildren, to this day, in the schools of France, are told that Joan was set up, that her trial was phony, that her burning was totally unjustified. When the group of clergy loyal to Charles reopened her case in Rouen in the 1450s, they appointed as chairman of the bench the Archbishop of Reims. No longer the old Rognaud de Chartres, not the man who had examined Joan at Poitiers, not the man who had crowned and anointed Charles in Reims, but his successor, Jean Juvenel des Ursins, member of a family fanatically loyal to the Valois kings and hand-picked by Charles himself for the vacant see of Reims. Flanking him on the bench, on the one side was the Bishop of Coutances and on the other the Bishop of Paris. just in case there was anybody in France who hadn't quite got the message, the clergy treated this case as of the utmost importance. And the three judges set about their business with great thoroughness. Anyone who's read their way through the transcript of that trial knows for themselves the thoroughness of the three judges who retried Joan in the 1450s. Of course, it's absurd. When we look back on it now, it's all absurd. It may or may not have been true that Joan was set up. It is highly improper anyway that she should have been tried by people who were fairly openly her enemies. But if the first trial was a set-up, then of course the second trial is equally ridiculous. The Archbishop and his two bishop fellow judges, all three of them, owed their jobs to Charles. Charles had personally appointed all three of them, and Charles owed his job to Joan, and Joan was on trial. In the absurd history of absurd trials, in the absurd history of Europe, this must be an ultimate absurdity. But to this day, very few people in France actually challenge the verdicts of that trial. The key verdict, of course, was the lapse into heresy rap on which Joan was burnt. There were some other charges which were apparently treated as convictions by the court in its final version, which do not appear to have figured very much in the actual procedures as we have them verbatim, but which were added in by Pierre Cauchon later on in the series. If he actually did this after the proceedings were completed, then of course it was deeply irregular. But that isn't something which I want to go into now. It's something which we can leave to the legal historians to wrangle out. It is perhaps not entirely surprising what the final verdicts of the Archbishop and his two fellow judges were when Joan's trial was not only reopened, but the proceedings were finally completed. They decided that on all the charges which had been brought against her, whether penciled in later or dealt with in open court, Joan was not guilty. And the care with which that trial was conducted suggests to us, in retrospect, two conclusions which we must deal with provisionally, cautiously. The judges were certainly very cautious, and we have no record whatever of what they felt about it outside the court proceedings themselves. But on the one hand, it is fairly clear that they wanted to leave a very detailed record, almost a set of notes towards a biography of the girl who had put Charles on the throne. The number of witnesses they called and the detail which they elicited from those witnesses is, of course, marvellous for us, but quite extraordinary in the context of a trial where they could, at the most minimal version, have simply examined the transcript of the previous trial, found the procedures totally inadequate, and simply annulled the verdicts. But they didn't do this. The second point, which comes across to us, at least provisionally, as we look at this transcript so many centuries later, is that these three judges were determined by the textbook purity of their procedures, their extraordinary attention to the detail of the canon law, that they did not want this case ever to come back into court again. And 5.5 centuries later, we can say that so far they have been extremely successful. The myth, then, of Joan of Arc has got a whole host of fascinating features attaching to them. Those two transcripts are not the least of them. And one of the things that we see as we look at her story is, of course, that this is an exceptional case, almost a piece of dramatist's fiddling, because here is a character who is not only apparently the best documented character anywhere in the world in the 15th century, and apparently she is, but we actually have a diptych of legal proceedings which deal with her life history. On the one hand, she is tried by her enemies, found guilty, and executed. On the other hand, she is tried by her friends, found not guilty, and exonerated for all time henceforth. If Shakespeare had done it, we would have said that it was a cheap dramatic trick. But Shakespeare didn't do it. Shakespeare seems to have been extremely nervous of Joan of Arc and steered largely clear of her. And I'll leave open the question who actually wrote the three parts of Henry VI. But the point is that in Shakespeare's time, Joan was still a very sore point in the England of that in the England of that period. But this is apparently no cheap dramatic trick. Joan was apparently tried by her enemies, and she was apparently tried by her friends. The verdicts were opposite, but the point that is of interest to us when we begin to look at the whole subject of myths in a broader context is, of course, that here we can see people quite consciously trying, two groups of clergy opposed to each other, quite consciously trying to use the church courts to actually wrest the myth in directions favourable to their own side. One group of clergy want to discredit her, one group of clergy want to exonerate her and vindicate her. They want to lay very firmly the foundations of the myth which I told you in the last lecture, the story of the girl who saved Orleans and who put King Charles VII on the throne of France. Of course, the stakes were huge. When you look at those three judges sitting on that bench, you realise the weight that rested upon them. You realise the expectations that people from the royal family to the people in the villages must have had of those three judges. They presumably expected them to clear her name. There was a huge amount resting on her. I mean, I mentioned at the end of last week the legitimacy of all future French governments rested upon her. The respectability of the Valois branch of the royal house was utterly dependent on her. She had to be cleared of that charge of lapse into heresy. There was no serious alternative. And so in her story you can see, as it were, action myth. You can see people actually striving to rewrite the story to make the future brighter for the people who hope to rule France up ahead. Are we dealing here with objectivity? Are we dealing here with balanced, even-handed judgment? Of course we're not, nor is there any question of doing that. After all, human life isn't like that, is it? But the story as a story remains simply magnificent. It's a wonderful story. And the process of watching people try to turn it to their own account makes it in some ways even better. I mentioned a short time ago that Charles finally died in 1461, and he was succeeded by his son Louis. There was no resumption of the fighting. No one at the time could be quite sure what was going to happen. There was no reason to assume that the fighting had finally stopped. Nobody really knew at what point the King of England might not send another expeditionary force to France and start the fighting all over again. But of course, looking back now, we know that the fighting was over. Charles and Charles' side had won. And anyway, by 1461, civil war had broken out in England. There's a bitter irony in this story, because in France, the factions that squabbled around the crown had broken loose precisely because of the madness of Charles VI. And that madness, presumably genetically hereditary, had reappeared not in King Charles VII, the man that Joan had put on the throne, but in King Henry VI of England, who again like his grandfather, suffered from hereditary bouts of madness, and his madness opened the way to that series of bitter little civil wars that we now call the Wars of the Roses. In Paris, Charles did consider intervening in England as the English had intervened in France, but he decided against it, and he left the English to fight their civil wars in peace. We now have in the University of Kent a set of procedures which allow students at the end of each course to give the people who've taught the course their opinion of what it was like. And one year at the end, not so many years ago now, at the end of the course Systems of Ritual and Belief, one student wrote plaintively on the report form that they spent 2 whole weeks on Joan of Arc, 2 whole weeks on a single story. Clearly, they felt this is far too detailed to expect us to actually go through the Joan of Arc story for 2 whole weeks of the course. It's very interesting to try and work out what it is that students are expecting from courses. Sometimes I feel that they want a kind of quantity return. They want to feel they've got through, you know, 20 myths in 2 weeks or something of this kind. Clearly, this particular student, I don't know who they were, had missed the point entirely. Anyone who knows the story of Joan of Arc and the place of Joan in French life, in French experience, her place in French history, the way she's taught to French schoolchildren, knows everything about myths. This is all you need to know. Once you know Joan and her story and modern France and what it's all about, you know what myths are about. You don't need to learn any more. If you do your homework on Joan properly, you know everything. Now, to your great relief, I'm not going to try and tell you everything about her or everything about myths or everything we can learn about myths from her, because I'm going to leave you to do that for yourselves. If you're interested in myths, you can do it all. But Joan provides the starting point for all of it. She is a wonderful beginning, a wonderful take-off point, because this is the story which has got everything. As far as I can see, there's nothing missing. Everything in human storytelling is here. There are all sorts of ways in which one can talk about it. I'm not going to do that. But one has to remember that the people of France, and indeed the people of Western Europe in Joan's time, were thoroughly habituated to stories of knights in shining armour who ride in out of the sunrise, very much like cowboys in a modern Western, and who rescue damsels in distress and kill the dragons and do all the things that were required of these knights in shining armour in the heroic literature, much of it indeed Arthurian literature, of this period. The soldiers, therefore, who followed Joan onto that bridge, who followed her between the hedges, cannot have failed to see the humour of the drama in which they were in real life involved. Because in this particular story, the damsel in distress was Charles, and the knight in shining armour, and it really was shining armour because she had a special white suit of armour, the knight in shining armour was a damsel. And the joke which this story is within the context of feudal Europe and the story of chivalrous literature is, of course, unmistakable, and very few of Joan's contemporaries can have missed that joke. Less of a joke for the soldiers who collapsed against her, for the soldiers who ran away. Less of a joke for Shakespeare and his contemporaries coping with a South Bank London audience in the late 16th or early 17th century, because, of course, this joke had turned English soldiers into the laughingstock of Western Europe. We all know what Joan was guilty of. I mean, she wasn't guilty of any of the things the clergy charged her with in her first trial. Of course she wasn't. We all know she wasn't. She was guilty of nothing. But she was guilty of shattering the hopes of the Plantagenet royal house, of ruining the life of the Duke of Bedford, and, I've mentioned already, of turning English soldiers into the laughing stock of Western Europe. That's guilt, isn't it? Even if it's not legal guilt or guilt under the canon law. We know who she is. We know where she stands. We know why the English have writhed under her memory for centuries since her time. And this whole story, which is still alive, of course, conspicuously far more alive in France than it is in England, this story is a very shining example of all sorts of things, and I won't try and talk about all of them. I remember way back in the June of 1967, during a short, sharp war in which Israel took the Golan Heights and the West Bank and overran the Sinai Peninsula and ended up on the banks of the Suez Canal, I was talking to an American woman who had just recently seen the movie A Man for All Seasons, the Schofield Sir Thomas More. And as I talked to her about this film, I realised that it meant absolutely nothing to her. She hadn't got the faintest clue what the story of Sir Thomas More is all about, or why Robert Bolt bothered to write a stage script for it, or why he then bothered to turn it into a film script. It was quite clear that this film had left her completely cold. And at that point, I had that awful temptation. Perhaps academics are more prone to this temptation than other people, but I had that awful temptation to explain the story of Sir Thomas More to her. I'm relieved to say, my conscience remains clear, and I can say I never did try to explain it to her because the warning signs came up too soon and I obeyed them. One does not explain the story of Sir Thomas More. The story of Sir Thomas More explains human life. And in the same way, of course, the story of Joan of Arc needs no explaining. It is the explanation that explains us. Sir Thomas and Joan are our explainers. We are not theirs. And so the one thing I'm not going to do in this course, of course, is to try to explain her story. She needs no explaining. She needs no apologists now. However, what about myths? I've called this a myth, and some of you may well agree with a student in another seminar group of long ago who said, well, this isn't myth, this is history. You know, this is history. Myths are quite different from this. And that takes us right into the problem which I touched on in the last lecture, and which I can no longer go on putting off. What exactly are these stories that we are calling myths? Well, the simplest way to begin is to go back to the beginnings. Let's track these stories back far beyond Joan of Arc, far beyond Sir Thomas More. Let's go back into the world of classical Greece and to what Amuthos meant to Pericles or to some of these other figures of that period. Now, this is not exactly a straightforward subject. I mean, quite a lot has been written about this by classicists, and in a sense, I am rushing in here where angels fear to tread. But very simply, of course, one can talk about the kinds of stories which were muthoi, plural of muthos, which were muthoi in classical Greece, and which indeed continued to be muthoi into the Hellenistic monarchies and into the Roman Empire. A muthos was a story about the great doings of the great past. One can really tell people what myths are by looking at the myths as they were understood by the classical Greeks. The story of the Trojan War was a myth. The story of the royal houses of Thebes and of Argos and of Athens and of all these other Greek cities were myths. Therefore, of course, the story of Agamemnon was a myth. The story of Oedipus was a myth. The story of Theseus was a myth. The story of Perseus was a myth. Stories about Heracles were myths. What do myths have in common? They have in common the fact that they relate to the past. that they are about great events. They are about heroic people, famous people from the past. And they have the ring of historicity about them. This is very important. They are not fictional. Indeed, the Greek usage of myth comes very close to history. It's worth remembering that Herodotus, a venerable figure from that period, who set out to try and get as close as possible to the record of the past as he possibly could, given the difficulties of doing that, clearly regarded the Trojan War as something which had actually happened. He did not treat it with the kind of scepticism that some 19th century classicists might have heaped upon it. Herodotus clearly believed that there had been a Trojan War, and that the Trojan War was, as we would say, historical. But he wouldn't have doubted, I suppose, that it was a myth. It was a myth because of its character as a great story that was told. And this, I suppose, is one of those things that one has to say about myths, that myths are not necessarily fiction at all. They may be fiction, but they're not necessarily fiction, and they may indeed be well-founded in events that did occur. So that when we talk about myths, we have to take seriously the way the classical Greeks talked about them, with a certain respect, with a certain sense of awe about their own past, which told them their own identity. And this practice, which has come into general use in the English language, not Greek, but in the English language, of using the word myth to mean a falsehood, a fiction, something which has been made entirely up. What the Honourable Lady has told this house is a myth. This kind of usage is a usage quite alien to Herodotus, quite alien apparently to Plato, and quite alien to the classical Greeks, as far as we know them. The notion that a myth is a falsehood or a fiction, even a lie, an outright, downright lie, this kind of usage, regular enough, I know, in modern English, is not a usage which I'm going to use for the purposes of this series. I prefer to get much closer to the classical Greeks and to talk about myths in their sense. One definition would be the great stories of the great past. By that definition, Joan of Arc certainly classifies. Certainly, if the story of Joan of Arc had been told in classical Athens, I don't for a moment doubt they would have called it a mythos. And similarly, if an anthropologist had collected the story of Joan of Arc somewhere in the middle of the Congo Basin, among a Bantu-speaking people who had no writing at the time that story was collected, I don't for a moment doubt that story would be called a myth without any qualifications whatever. We call it a myth, I suppose, because it sounds like a myth. We all have a sort of bloodstream gut feeling of what a myth is like. And Joan of Arc is a myth. I mean, she meets all the criteria. Now, as I've said, myths are not straightforward to classify, and indeed there's very good evidence that human beings will never agree on formal definitions of what myths are. But in more intuitive, in more poetic, in more dramatic terms, people are largely agreed about what myths are, and it's fairly clear that just as the Trojan War and the story of how Theseus killed the Minotaur, or the various tales of Heracles, just as these are clearly myths, clearly the story of Joan of Arc is a myth too. It has that quality of the heroic. Indeed, interesting enough, it is actually less credible than many of the Greek myths. It is actually a great deal less credible than many of the Greek myths. It's a story which would have caused wonder in the streets of Athens had they had the privilege of hearing it, which of course they didn't. Now, you will gather by now that what I'm saying about myths is not that they are the opposite of history. I am not saying that myths are a set of totally fictitious stories about the past and that history is the totally reliable stories about the past. That won't work, of course, because anyone who knows anything about the business of writing history knows how shaky it all is. when you actually get back into the history books, you realise, of course, that what you are being told is problematic, that you're being told one or two historians' views of something which happened. Hopefully they have looked carefully at all the relevant documents which relate to their period and to their subject, but when they come to write it all down, when they enter into the process of historiography, what happens is they produce a new version of what happened, which in the course of time somebody perhaps will regard as a myth. When we look at what French schoolchildren and English schoolchildren are taught in their schools, what we are looking at is strictly myths. We're looking at national myths. We're looking at the way in which the French past is related to the French students of the present. We are looking at the way in which the English past is related to the English students of the present. Interestingly enough, if you go to France and listen to what the French are being told about what happened during the 15th century, you will find that it is strikingly different from what is being told to English students about that same period, although it is difficult to believe that it really was all quite as different as that when it happened. And we realise, of course, that what is in the history books is versions. It is not what happened. It is a whole set of approximations to what happened, various people trying to get close to the action. Creditable, but not that easy. So from what I'm saying, you're beginning to get some sort of sense of what I am saying is the difference between history and myth. History, as a subject, is a serious attempt to get back into what happened, however difficult that may be. History is a very difficult subject, at least that is my opinion of it. Mythology, on the other hand, which I regard as a much less difficult subject than history, and here I'm not making any sort of special pleading for my own interest, because I reckon that historians have got the rough edge of this deal. Mythology, on the other hand, deals with narratives which people relate about the past. It's a much more up to the moment subject, because we're dealing with how audiences react. We're dealing with how storytellers speak. We're dealing with processes of interaction between the teller and the hearer. We're not dealing with documents dealing in archives, but with the way in which those documents are now rendered, or indeed forgotten. In modern France, much of the content of the documents of Joan of Arc's time are effectively forgotten in the narratives of Joan which are recited. Joan has become a French patriot. She has been romanticised. She's been much affected by the Enlightenment, which I've mentioned already in this series. She's been much affected by the Romantic movement. She's been hugely affected by the emergence of romantic chauvinism of a kind which has affected all, literally all, the peoples of Europe in the period since about 1750. We've all been swept along by it. We've all rediscovered our histories. The English have rewritten their histories. Victorian English, Victorian Welsh, Victorian Irish and Victorian Scots all rewrote the histories of their respective countries. And this process, not surprisingly, has affected, unavoidably, Joan of Arc, who is by far the most dramatic figure in the whole of the historical records of France anyway. When we look, therefore, at the Joan of Arc who is being taught to French school children, what we see is a patriot, a modern French romantic heroine who emerges from her village to save the man born to be king and to drive the English invaders into the sea. I can't believe for a moment that Joan would actually recognise herself in the modern French history books. The girl that we read about in the 15th century documents was fighting in a civil war. She was not a patriot who drove out the foreigners. Joan of Arc, as far as we know, had no real animus against the English or the Welsh at all. Nor was she fighting for a France of the kind that, shall we say, Charles de Gaulle was fighting for in the 1940s. What she was fighting for was, as far as we can tell, to put the man who had the right to be the King of France, the man whom God had chosen to be the King of France, on that throne and to keep him there. To do this, she had to fend off the strenuous Plantagenet bid. She had to fight against the English and the Welsh soldiers who fought for the Plantagenets, but she was not fighting for some abstract, glorified France. She would hardly perhaps have recognised not merely the Marseillaise as a song, but even the sentiments that are represented in the Marseillaise. This was quite alien to the world in which she lived. The world in which she lived was late feudal, and her loyalties were personal to Charles, and Charles she wanted to make king. She did not even regard herself as French. It's fairly clear that she regarded herself as a Lorrainer, and she used to use an expression which, translated into modern English, would be something like, "when I first came into France," meaning when I left Domremy and Vaucouleurs and moved westwards to places like Orleans and other places like that, where she came into a foreign country and met people who were speaking quite different dialects from the ones that she was used to. In her book on Joan, in her book Jeanne d'Arc, the French historian Régine Pernoud sets out at the very beginning to tell us what it is that she wants to do in this book, that she wants to take us away from the images of Joan of Arc with which we, as 20th century sort of people, have grown up. And she wants to get back into the documents. She wants to engage in an exercise in what she calls l'histoire scientifique. Perhaps in English, I mean, that means something like analytical history. She wants to go back into the original sources, which have survived happily, of course, for historians of her specialism, in very great numbers. And she wants to recapture and then write into modern French the story of this France in which Joan was born, in which she grew up, and in which her brief public career, not much more than 2 years, was played out. It's a very commendable objective, and it is very difficult to quarrel with Régine Pernoud's purposes or the methods which she seeks to use. But interestingly enough, as her story goes on, and you can read her book for yourselves, there is an English translation of it as well as the French original. It's a book that is widely available. As you go through this book, either in the translation or in the French original, you realise after a bit that the whole atmosphere is changing as we leave Vaucouleurs and ride across France to Chinon with Joan and with her escort, as we move on to the attack on the bridge at Orleans, and so it goes on. We find that there are some strange features in this story. We find, for example, that the English are fighting the French. Now, if you go back into the 15th century documents, you'll find that at no point are the English fighting the French. I've pointed out already there was a civil war in France. The French were fighting the French. The Welsh and the English were fighting on one side, the Scots were fighting on the other side. All sorts of people were sucked in. The Portuguese supported one side, the Castilians, their traditional enemies, supported the other side, of course. The Flemings were involved, the people in the Rhineland, people in Cologne and so on, they were all involved in this. It was a big war, it sucked in much of Atlantic Europe. But the point is, what it was not, if we can trust those 15th century documents, was the English fighting the French. At no point in the 15th century did the English fight the French. It didn't happen. And the imagery which Régine Pernoud is using is a much more modern French imagery, deeply imbued with the fighting between the English and the French, which broke out after the so-called Glorious Revolution in England, after the deposition of James II, and that whole complicated sequence of events which involves John Churchill and his kid brother and the young pretender and the old pretender and all that sort of story, which is a huge myth, and I'm not going to tell you that myth now, of course. But the point is, understandably, as a modern French woman, Régine Pernoud is hugely affected by it. She's affected by this long duel between the English and the French, and sucking in, of course, eventually the whole of the rest of Europe as well eventually even the Russians got sucked in. This is the kind of context in which Régine Pernoud is talking. She is not, at this point, talking about the 15th century at all. And as we go on even further in her account, we come to the point where she compares the Duke of Bedford's soldiers in Normandy with the German army of occupation in France during the 1940s. Again, we've come a very long way from the 15th century. But this leads me into another definition of myths, which is very well exemplified by Régine Pernoud's whole approach. Myths, let us say, are stories that take people over. They have this emotional power to change people. Here is a very high-minded French historian setting out to recapture the real Joan of Arc in her real setting, to use the authentic documents of her time, to use Joan's own words, to use the eyewitness accounts of the people who knew her. But in the midst of this attempt, Régine Pernoud herself is overwhelmed by things that have happened since 1700, by the experiences of her own lifetime in France, by the way in which the French have re-experienced themselves. That very process of turning Joan of Arc into a modern French patriot has affected Régine Pernoud as she sets out to go back behind that imagery of the modern French patriot to find the authentic feudal Joan of Arc, the Joan of Arc who fought for the king in that civil war of the 15th century. Now, I'm not surprised by this. I'm not attempting, for example, to hold Régine Pernoud up to ridicule. I'm not saying this is silly, this is absurd. What I'm saying is quite different from that. It must be extremely difficult if you are a French woman of the present time to be totally unmoved by the story of Joan of Arc. The story of Joan of Arc must have tremendous emotional impact on French women. All French women, after all, she is the supernal, ultimate, archetypal, mythical French woman. She is all French women. She is the French woman who redefines French identity. And France, of course, is a country peculiarly redefined, re-experienced in female terms because of Joan of Arc. The modern French imagery of France itself is dominated by young women. You find that La France is a young woman. Remember, Britannia is not a young woman. But La France is a young woman. La République is a young woman. La Révolution is a young woman. La Liberté is a young woman. That the imagery of young womanhood suffuses France. It is an overpowering force. And I suppose when we talk about myths, we talk about myths with trepidation. We talk about them with caution, because I remember that the Christian evangelist preacher Charles Spurgeon was once called upon to defend the Bible, and he replied, "I would as soon defend a roaring lion." Well, of course, the Bible is perhaps the greatest myth in human experience, and it's a myth which seems to be in process of taking over all other myths at the present time. And Spurgeon's reply seems to me very appropriate as I talk about Joan of Arc and about myths in general. Because myths are not there to be explained. They are not there to be, certainly not explained away. They are not there perhaps ultimately to be interpreted or to be translated. They are there to be experienced. We do not run myths. Myths run us. All of us are characters in myths, like Régine Pernoud, like Joan herself. We are all characters in a myth. The myth runs us. The script takes control. We are not in a position to take control of these myths. They are transmitted through us. They are using us. I'm often tempted, when talking about myths, to use the imagery of viruses. Viruses are remarkable beings. Specialists argue about whether they're living organisms. or whether they're not living organisms, whether they're just complex chemicals. I needn't go into that. Biologists have their own myths. But what I would say is that anyone who is suffering from a virus, supposing you've just had a nasty bout of flu this winter, will vouch for the fact that they certainly feel like living organisms when they're getting at you. But what is fascinating about viruses, and they are very, very fascinating beings, is that they have this capacity of invading a host and then hijacking the host's personal reserves of chemicals for their own use. So what they do is they take over a host's tissues, they extract from those tissues the bits they want, they reconstruct themselves and reproduce themselves using the tissues of the host, and then they push off into some other host, leaving the host, of course, totally shattered and in need of Marmite to build up their reserves of vitamin B, which, of course, have been entirely hijacked by the invading virus, which is now pushed off without any interest whatever, as far as we know, in what happens to their unfortunate recent host. And myths, although clearly one shouldn't push this analogy too close, but at the same time, myths are a bit like that. Myths actually use people to transmit themselves. They get storytellers to recite them, they get audiences to listen to them, and then they push on. The ancient Greeks, a good example because they're a long way away now, the ancient Greeks were absorbed by the stories of Homer. They were absorbed by the Iliad and by the Odyssey. They listened to these stories. They were preoccupied by these stories. They elaborated these stories. They probably even dreamed about them on occasion. And they saw these stories in very much the same way as the modern French experience the Joan of Arc story. This is a story which has consuming power. It is part of us. We have inherited it from the past. We will transmit it to the future. The story seems to have a power of its own, a life of its own, an ability to actually take us over and project us forward. This is something which one can see in France itself. Again, one doesn't need to move far beyond the Joan of Arc story, because in an extraordinary way, that story has reproduced itself in some respects during the 20th century. In 1940, the French went back yet again into massive crisis. The various factions in France redivided themselves, very much as they'd redivided themselves, of course, in the 1420s, in Joan's time. Some of those factions set up a provisional capital south of the Loire. Others allied themselves with the King of England. When we turn to 1940, however, of course, we realise that the story is rather different from the story as we experience it in 1428 and 1429. We find that the forces who ally themselves with the King of England are now identified in the French national myth as the good guys. They set up a provisional government in St. John's Wood, of all places, in London. Meanwhile, of course, the bad guys who set up their capital south of the Loire, very much as Charles himself had set it up south of the Loire in the 15th century, these guys, it turns out, are now the bad guys, the Vichy government, the hated Vichy government of the 1940s. But at the same time, of course, are we surprised to learn that both the Vichy government and La France Libre, with their capital in St. John's Wood, both claimed that Joan of Arc was on their side? Can you believe that? Oh yes, you can believe that, can't you? Joan of Arc was fighting for La France Libre, and she was also fighting for the Vichy French. And indeed, of course, when one looks at that period, it is easy to believe. I mean, I have long felt myself that de Gaulle saw himself as some sort of reincarnation of Joan of Arc, and I was amused recently to discover that in 1944, a commentator in the Times newspaper in London made exactly the same observation. They said that de Gaulle does seem to see himself as a reincarnation of Joan of Arc. One student who took part in this course at one stage in her career, came back to me afterwards at a later point in her student life, and she said, you know, it is absolutely amazing what you said about the French. When you go to France and you start looking around, you suddenly realise, of course, that Joan of Arc is everywhere, that she speaks to you, you know, sort of out of the mouths of all French people. She's in every town, she's in every street. You can't get away from Joan of Arc. She is somehow, you know, she is France. And one of the things which I suppose is particularly gratifying about anyone who's interested in the Joan of Arc story or who's interested in myths is the way in which in the whole of the northern half of France there are places wherever you go which are associated with her. She is associated, of course, with Domremy, with Vaucouleurs, she's associated with Bourges, she's associated with Chinon, she's associated par excellence with Orléans. Orléans is still her emotional capital in France. She's associated with one place after another, with Compiègne, where she was captured, with Rouen, where she was tried and burnt. And this is typical of myths, that very often they root themselves into a landscape. If you go to Ireland, again and again you will come to the place where Patrick slept. Very often it's an old long barrow from a period, presumably, long before Patrick's time, but this is a place where Patrick slept. You go up past the old thorn on the hill and you come to the remains of the long barrow, and this is the place where Patrick slept. You come to the wells where Patrick drank. You come to the wells which Patrick blessed. Patrick is a pervasive figure. I won't get carried away here into another national myth, but within Ireland, of course, Patrick is a pervasive figure. You cannot get away from him. A great many of the modern Irish, of course, are actually named after him. He is a pervasive personality of the same kind as Joan of Arc. And when you go to France, you find the same sort of thing. Joan was here. And as a matter of interest, as far as we know, she really was. I mean, there's not the slightest doubt, as far as I can see, that she was at some stage at Compiègne, that she was at one stage at Paris, that she was at one stage at Orléans. Now, what I'm going to do at this point is to stop. I've said quite enough about myths, although, of course, I'm very aware of another student who took this course and who said something which was very salutary to me at the end of it. She said, when we started this course, I knew what myths were, but now I don't. So I said to her, well, can you remember what they were when you started? And she said, no. And I suppose part of the problem with myths is that they are likely to have that effect upon you. But don't doubt it, they are important. Whether we like it or not, we are characters in a myth, and we are all of us at this moment being affected by myths, whether we know it or not. And the ones we don't know about are the ones that are certainly having the greatest effect upon us. Next time, in the third lecture on myths, I'd like to take this subject a bit further and look at what myths are with reference to some other places elsewhere.